listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to the author of the new book, Blood, Gun, Money, about the flow of illegally traded American guns and how they fuel violence in Central America. Now, Major League Baseball is moving its upcoming All-Star game out of Atlanta. The league says that's because of Georgia's new voting law, which limits who can cast an absentee ballot and strengthens voter ID requirements, among other changes. Democrats and civil rights groups have criticized the law, saying it's aimed at depressing turnout among the state's African-American population. Other major companies like Coca-Cola and Delta Airlines have publicly condemned the Georgia law. That's all prompted Republican politicians at the state and national level to call for boycotts of those corporations and threaten to take away some of their tax breaks. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think businesses should move events or facilities to oppose certain political issues? When a company takes a stance you agree with, does it make you more likely to give them your business? When you disagree with them, does it make you more likely to look to their competitors? Should they face consequences for lawmakers if they criticize certain policies? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Thomas O'Gwin is professor of marketing and sociology and distinguished chair of business at the UW-Madison Business School. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
We see things like this from time to time. Leagues move big games because of political issues happening in the previously planned location. We've often seen leagues stay quiet. What's your reaction to baseball saying, hey, we're moving our All-Star game?
Well, I'll separate my answer into two parts. One is from two perspectives. One, me is my political beliefs, and one is a marketing guy. From a political side, I'm happy about it. I think corporations, if the courts are going to insist corporations are people, which is ridiculous in the first place, but if they're going to insist that they're people, then and I guess we it's only fair that we should be able to judge them as people and their speech. And I personally believe that there's just no doubt that this law was created to suppress minority vote. And now, from a marketing point of view, boycotts are sort of in the middle of the road in terms of effectiveness. Some are very successful, some are not. They are typically fairly short-lived. People who buy things very habitually will probably go back to their habits at some point. But corporations over the last 30 years have become much more political than they used to be or would like to be. I've talked to many CEOs who said, and chief marketing officers who say, you know, the biggest difference in my job now and when I started or when 20 years ago is that we can't do the Michael Jordan thing. And when he was asked to, you know, run for Congress in North Carolina and Nike didn't want him to. And he said, you know, even Republicans wear tennis shoes. And you know, so it used to be common wisdom that you just stayed out of politics. And but that there are very few corporations who feel that they can do that anymore.
How big a risk is there for companies to take a stance, not just on this issue, but any issue, knowing that they're maybe making part of their customer base happy with this decision, but they're alienating clearly another part of it? How do they weigh that decision of how much they gain versus how much they lose?
That is the question. And some companies, and it depends on how strong the CEO is versus the board of directors and all kind of internal politics. So you have, you know, companies where you have a very strong CEO that's a founder or something, and they're just going to say it's a moral issue, and I'm the majority stockholder, and I'm going to do it, and I don't care what you think. And on the other hand, you have a lot of companies who actually try to work out the math on it and hire a lot of public opinion people and say, which way will we get hurt more? And the phrase you commonly hear is being on the right side of history. So they what they're trying to predict is where will the majority of the population in their market be, not today, but in a year, 5 years. Companies that kind of played along with segregationists in the 50s and 60s didn't fare well. Companies that softly came out for greater civil rights tended to do better. So there is a sense that if you're on the right side of history, you'll be rewarded.
We're talking to Tom O'Gwin from the UW-Madison Business School about companies taking political stances, whether that's moving an all-star game out of Georgia in response to changes in voting laws, or any big political issue that companies choose to or not to make a statement on. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell shared his thoughts earlier this week. Here's some of what he had to say.
My warning, if you will, to corporate America is to stay out of politics. It's not what you're designed for. And don't be intimidated by the left into taking up causes that put you right in the middle of one of America's greatest political debates.
McConnell went on to say he wasn't talking about political donations, and today he walked it back a little bit and said more, you didn't really fully understand the Georgia law. So I don't know. Is this a question about the right way for corporations to get involved in politics, make donations but don't make public statements versus boycotting a state with your events? How do you sort out, Tom, those different ways of corporations getting involved?
Again, good question. Senator McConnell has a short memory, obviously, given their stance, wanting corporations to take stances. And if you really want to go back, the history of the United States and commerce from the Boston Tea Party on has been political. The former CEO of Coca-Cola, back until 1980-something, he ran the company for 80 years or 70 years. Supposedly the guy who talked Dwight David Eisenhower into being a Republican, because Eisenhower didn't know what party he was. Companies have always had some degree of politics, and usually through lobbyists. There's no shortage of lobbyists in D.C. But I think what's happened largely because of social media is that the accountability, the immediate accountability and feedback loop towards CEOs, CMOs, boards of directors is so swift and can gain so much momentum and so much press than a few letters can, that I think you are forced to make some public pronouncements. I understand there's an app. I don't know if it's still around, but there's an app you can get where you can take your iPhone or whatever and look at the barcode on a can of any or a bottle of anything, and it will tell you whether that company has, what percent of their contributions have been to Democrats or Republicans. And you can judge, a bottle of wine, whatever, to find out if they're a red or a blue company. So, I think a lot of people have gotten interested in this topic. I don't think you're going to see a shortage of lobbyists, and I don't think you're going to see a shortage of dark money. But I think the difference will be CEOs and marketing officers coming out of their offices and having to make public statements.
We're talking to Tom O'Gwin, professor of marketing and sociology at UW-Madison School of Business, looking at the response from corporations to Georgia's new voting restrictions, the Republican response to that, and wider issues of when and how businesses do politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see companies taking public stances on controversial political issues, maybe moving their business, their events away from certain places based on those issues? Would you rather they stay out, or do you support businesses that do that on issues you agree with and oppose businesses when you disagree with their stance? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Tom O'Gwin, professor of marketing and sociology at UW-Madison, looking at the response to Georgia's new voting law. Some big companies publicly condemning it, even in the case of Major League Baseball moving an event, the All-Star Game, out of Georgia, and Republican lawmakers telling those companies to stay out of this kind of politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. Let's go to your calls now. Eli is with us in La Crosse. Eli, hello.
Hi. My comment is I don't believe that companies should be making political statements about democracy when they actively participate in manufacture of products in China and other Southeast Asian countries where they are just taking advantage of the population. For example, Patagonia just donated $1 million plus to a quote-unquote charity for to help protect democracy, yet they own something like 13 plants in China that have internment camps in them.
Eli, thanks a lot for the call. And Tom, Eli's not the only one raising this concern. Whether you like the Georgia voting law or not, a lot of these international companies are trying to either make products in a authoritarian country like China or sell their products there. Does this raise concerns about hypocrisy?
Oh, sure. I mean, companies? Hypocritical? You're kidding. Yeah, of course they do. I mean, they do hypocritical things all the time. They'll give you elaborate rationalizations for it. And sometimes they really believe it. But the caller makes an excellent point. I mean, it's hard to stand up for human rights on one issue and support essentially child slave labor on another. And so I think the caller, you know, makes a great point. The world has changed. And I know mostly about the United States, I admit, but the world has changed. Like, in business schools now, there's a lot of, when you teach, there's a lot of attention paid to sort of a more socially responsible capitalism, sometimes called conscious capitalism or something. I mean, there is a belief, which you wouldn't have heard in a business school even 20 years ago. I do think at least in the United States, millennials and Gen Z kind of expect more moral behavior out of public companies. But you're right. When you go in with transnationals, if you work for a transnational, you will commonly find yourself enacting policies that hurt your neighbors, that hurt your country, that don't help democracy. And I think transnationals are one of the bigger problems, because they don't fly under a national flag or an ideology. They're just a huge company that spans the globe.
Eli, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Scott with us in Madison. Scott, hi.
Afternoon. I find it rather ironic. Wasn't it the Republican Party that pushed until the Supreme Court finally stated that the corporations have the same right to free speech as the individual?
Scott, thanks for the call. Scott, referring to a couple of Supreme Court decisions, Tom, that allowed corporations to expand their donations to politicians and political causes. Do corporations face as much pushback or boycotts and things like that for that political donation they make to a candidate as for a public statement on a controversial issue?
No, because a lot of it flies under the radar, and they don't. Some is reported publicly, some is not. So I mean, it's much harder to track that. I think public statements are just such a new thing for corporations, relatively speaking, that the public is just not, in the United States, is not used to it. Now, they've been doing it in Western Europe a lot longer. I mean, the Brits and the French, their companies were, go back to the, even before the Thatcher era, as being overtly political, but it's sort of new to the United States. Yeah, it's the Robert Reich quote about, I'll start treating companies like people when Texas executes one of them. But I've also met free speech advocates who are liberal, but at the same time have a hard time parsing where free speech starts and stops, commercial speech and political speech. So I don't think that question is necessarily as cut and dried as everyone thinks.
Thanks a lot for that call. Tom, as we wrap up, do you think this is going to be more of a minefield for corporations in the years to come?
I think it's going to be more common behavior. Whether it's a minefield or not depends on how adept they are at it and how commonplace it gets to be for companies. Now, there's some, like, take Coca-Cola and Delta. Coca-Cola is a brand that people are almost religious about. I mean, they're just fanatically brand loyal to Coca-Cola. So I can see this having a bigger effect on Coca-Cola than I can on Delta, because Delta, but you're just another airline. They're almost a commodity. People don't have the same kind of loyalty to airlines as they do to Coca-Cola, which for over 100 years was the most valuable brand in the United States. So, I think it's going to just continue. I think social media will push it further, and I think it'll get normalized.
We'll leave it there. Tom, thanks for joining us again.
Sure, my pleasure.
Thomas O'Gwin is a professor of marketing and sociology in the UW-Madison Business School. He talked with us about the reaction from some major companies to Georgia's new voting law and the backlash from Republicans who say they should stay out of politics. WPR and Wisconsin Watch are documenting the lives of Wisconsinites in this unprecedented time with a series of audio diaries called Outbreak Wisconsin. With many K-12 classes meeting online over the last year, parents and educators have worried about the social and emotional impact on kids. Julie Welch teaches sixth grade for the La Crosse School District's Virtual Academy. She says she's been able to form a new kind of relationship with her students, even though they aren't in a classroom.
My first live interaction with students is at 8:30 in the morning. We have something that we call a morning meeting, where just like if we were in person, when kids arrive, we start the day in a circle and greeting each other and just kind of doing that check-in, like, hey, how are you doing? What's new? What do you have to share? Because this is a virtual academy, the only required time for them to come is that first morning meeting. If they're independent and able to work on their own, they can read the directions and do the work, then I might not see them the rest of that day. My whole career, I have championed for equity in education, and so I was a little reserved or a little concerned that I wouldn't have diversity in my classroom and it wouldn't be an equitable, balanced group of students. And again, I've been pleasantly surprised. Yes, I do have families that have made the commitment to stay home or to make sure their child is with a grandparent. And some of my students are the caregiver to their siblings. I have students that are home because of medical concerns. And I have students who are home because their parents just didn't want the back and forth of, okay, we're in school for 2 weeks. Oh, now we have to be home for 2 weeks. I do have a few that struggle. They have poor internet connections at home, or they maybe have too many commitments at home of other things that distract. I personally don't have any students that are just checked out, not trying. They're all absolutely doing the very best that they can, and the families are as well. I've gotten to know them and their families super well because I'm in their living rooms and, you know, bedrooms, and I see what's happening in their houses and they see what's happening in mine. You know, they've met my pets and I've met theirs, and we've helped each other through some hard times. I I lost my dog this year and she died and my kids were heartbroken with me because they knew her. They saw her every day. And so when that happened, they actually helped me through that. There are some of my students who are struggling with being isolated, and it's not perfect. This isn't the perfect way to learn for all students. So, you know, definitely at the semester, there were a few students that made the switch to go back. When I ask how they feel, you know, a lot of them say, oh, I wish we could be back in person, and I really miss my friends, and I miss seeing people in person. And so we talk about that. I've tried to open up more just social times and times for them to connect. And there are times where I'll finish my lesson. I'm like, you're welcome to go get some work done, or I can leave this Zoom open for 15 minutes, and you all can just chat and laugh and talk. And it's so fun just to listen to them, and they're your kids, and it's kind of like sitting in the corner of the room. You know, I'm just there as a guide on the side, but I don't really say much, and I let them just interact and get the socialization that they need. You know, it's amazing to me how it's not the same as being in school and being in a classroom with each other, but it isn't as remote and lonely as I thought it would be.
To hear more stories like this one, visit WPR.org/outbreakWisconsin. Coming up, the author of the new book, Blood, Gun, Money, follows the Iron River of illegal gun trafficking in American cities and south across the border with Mexico. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to the author of the new book, Blood, Gun, Money, How America Arms Gangs and Cartels. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about two friends who served in the Vietnam War.
James Blankenheim and Everett Wood are friends with a shared experience of military service during the Vietnam War. They speak of the excitement of forging one's path in life, the realities of combat, and the struggles of integration after returning home. Blankenheim and Wood shared their experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative. As a warning, parts of the story describe battleground violence.
My name is Jim Blankenheim, 71 years old, and I'm in Madison, Wisconsin. And my partner here is a corpsman that was with me in Vietnam.
My name's Everett T. Wood, and my age is 73. And I'm in Vincennes, Indiana. The relationship to Jim is he was a forward observer with us and called in artillery airstrikes and tried to help us out during the bad times when we needed help. So how did you get involved? Did you get drafted?
No, I enlisted. My father, when I turned 18, made the comment that he thought I'd never amount to shit. And I said, I'll show you. And not only would I join the military, but I would join the toughest branch they had. That's how I got in the Marine Corps. And also, I felt I needed to do my duty anyway. It's run through our family. So how about you, Doc?
Well, I got off high school. I didn't know what I wanted to do in life. My parents didn't have very much money. You know, I didn't want them to help me through school. You know, I just wanted to be on my own and try to find my own direction, I guess. So I joined the Navy. So remember Hill 1192?
Oh, yeah. That was probably the bloodiest battle we saw.
That was the worst I've ever gone through.
There was like 80 of us walked up into the mountains on what they said was going to be a three-day patrol. What was it, 15 days later we got out of there? Huh?
15 guys died up on that hill.
We had no place to put the bodies or the wounded, so they all laid right in the middle of our mini our mini perimeter, and Milligan was there. He got shot in the chest and shot in the leg.
Right. I patched him up.
He lasted 4 days before we could medevac him out. And when he went out, I thought he was dead. I thought he'd never make it. We went to that reunion in Ohio, and he showed up there, and I went, "You got to be kidding me. You're alive?"
I know.
Because I didn't think he made it.
I didn't even know.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, once they left, we put them on a helicopter.
Yeah, it's the last you heard.
I mean, you don't know if they're alive or dead. They never hear from them. So it's tough.
Did you write home?
I wrote home when I could, you know.
I could not tell my mother what was going on over there because it would have killed her.
Yeah, I know.
I just said, you know, like, you know what it was for us for a typical day? That's all I called it. You remember when we came home? The welcome home we got?
I don't know. I mean, I had problems adjusting when I came back.
Yeah, so did I.
I kissed the ground when I got home, when I got in.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I come home, and I walk in the door, and my dad was totally unaware that I was even coming home. And I walked in, and he gave me this big hug. And in my entire life, he never hugged me like that. And I said, you know, for every rotten thing you ever did to me, you paid for it that day.
I mean, I was really happy to be back after seeing all the stuff we went through. I'm glad we made it through that experience together.
Yeah.
And after all these years, meeting each other again.
That was James Blankenheim of Madison, Wisconsin, and Everett Wood of Vincennes, Indiana. They shared their experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Tyler Ditter.
Now, as drugs move north into the United States, guns move south into Mexico. About 70% of guns confiscated in Mexico between 2014 and 2018 and then submitted for tracing were found to be made or sold in the U.S. It's according to a Government Accountability Office report. That number doesn't include all firearms in Mexico. Our next guest is a journalist who's been writing about Latin America for two decades. His latest book digs into the world of the illegal firearms trade and how that market fuels violence in U.S. cities and in Latin America. He talked to undercover ATF agents, members of gangs in the U.S. and Mexico, legal arms manufacturers, and illegal weapons traffickers. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about the world of illegal gun trafficking? Do you have questions about drug violence in Central America and its connection to the flow of guns in the U.S.? Do you think laws need to change? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Yoan Grillo is a journalist and the author of the new book, Blood, Gun, Money, How America Arms Gangs and Cartels. Yoan, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here.
I gave just one statistic there. Yoan, can you talk more about the impact that guns that move from the U.S. south have in places like Mexico and further south in Central America?
Yeah, well, it's huge here. I've been covering the violence here for 20 years and seen things really fall apart. And the issue of guns flowing south is massive and has been for some time, as well as, you know, you've seen numbers of traced in the last 12 years, definitively traced 164,000 firearms taken from criminals, including the most violent cartels, and traced to shops and factories in the United States. But that's only the guns they're seized. They are estimates that the real number is above 200,000 guns being trafficked south every year, over 2 million in a decade. Now, the type of guns we're seeing is particularly AR-15s, AK-47 type rifles, often that are sold semi-automatic in the United States and converted in Mexico to fully automatic, but also weapons like Barrett 50s, and we've seen those being used in fights against the Mexican military, against the Mexican police. And here, really, what I would describe as a mix, a hybrid of crime and war, a real falling apart of the country. So a real substantial impact.
Now, the focus of your book is really on this line between a product that is made legally, it's made in factories that are regulated, it's sold in many cases legally, and then how those products find their way into this network of illegal trafficking. And part of what you found was that a lot of people haven't done the work to find out how this is happening. How much coming into this did you realize we just don't know how this happens?
Well, it was interesting. I've been covering drug trafficking for many years, and there's been a lot written about drug trafficking and about drugs and the drug trade. But the illegal gun trade, I think, is understudied. So there are a lot of the research, which I thought hadn't been done, in talking to gun sellers in the United States, in cities like Baltimore, people who are trafficking guns in illegally from southern states, gun traffickers in prison in Mexico, and all kinds of people in this industry. And what I found was you have the biggest legal firearms retail market in the world in the United States, bigger than the next 25 countries combined. But you also have this parallel black market in firearms. And so you see that most murders are committed in the United States by people who have acquired their guns illegally, and in Latin America as well, in fact, of people who have acquired guns illegally from the United States. And I looked at the ways they cross from the legal to the black market, like an invisible line. And you see things like straw buying, where people who are paid money, who have clean records, to go into a shop and buy guns. And it was amazing how this is being done. And we're seeing things like single sales of people buying 85 guns, people going in and buying 10 identical AK-47s, supposed housewives buying several Barrett 50s in cash. So I see a lot of kind of low-hanging fruit, which is not done in terms of enforcement on this issue.
Right. Let's stick with straw buying for a moment. If I'm that straw buyer, somebody hands me a lot of cash, some of it I get to keep, some goes toward buying the guns. I'm not at a huge risk of getting into trouble if I'm that straw buyer. Can you talk about the consequences?
Yeah, sure. So it's interesting that I discovered that there isn't a federal firearms trafficking law in the United States. So there's a bunch of these smaller laws. It's very different than going after drugs, where you have this very, very strong conspiracy laws to go after drug traffickers. Whereas with guns, you have these smaller laws, and one of them is lying on the form. So basically, if you go in the shop, somebody says, here's some money, go and buy the gun, go to the shop, and the crime is lying on the form, and the recommended punishment is probation. Now, it can be up to 10 years by the books, but the recommended punishment is probation. So most people are only getting probation. Even in one case I looked at, where a person walked in, bought 10 AK-47s for a cartel affiliate. One of those guns was used in the murder of an American agent in Mexico, an ICE agent, and he still only got probation. So you see how these sentences are very low, or punishments are very low for this crime, and there's very little deterrent, which then brings the gun police, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, into these very, very dubious operations like Fast and Furious, where they followed guns going to Mexico to try and build a bigger case, and it really blew up in their faces.
Another network you saw was, as you mentioned, part of this story is guns, part of it's drugs. You talked to a couple different people who were dealing illegal guns by trading illegal drugs for them. It's a fine way to make a profit. I can get these drugs cheaper. You can get these guns cheaper. Can you talk about how you found that works when you talked to the people actually making these transactions?
Yeah, sure. So I talked to somebody who was been convicted in New England area. He'd been in a prison gang called the Dirty White Boys, and he was picking up guns around rural New England towns, going to the city outside of Boston and trading them, in his case, with Dominican gang members for drugs. Now, you have these very, very elastic prices you see in these black market trades. So a gun in some small town in rural New England might not be seen as a high value or high worth. It's worth a lot more to these gangsters. Meanwhile, the drugs they're getting much cheaper over in New York, and they're worth much higher. So you see these prices going up very high. He was also have a sideline of buying bullets in Walmarts and then taking them and selling them for a dollar a round for these bullets. So he was making a lot of money, but only spending a lot of those money on drugs. And you see that's on a kind of low level. You see the same thing on a high level when you look at things like in Colombia. You have the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, who are a guerrilla group classified as a terrorist group by the United States, been involved in various bombings and so forth. And you see them on a very large level receiving these guns, some of them which in fact are coming from the United States in these networks and trading them for high amounts, high kilos of cocaine. So you see these interactions, this bartering between drugs and guns are all chains of these criminal networks.
We're talking to Johan Grillo about his new book, Blood, Gun, Money, How America Arms Gangs and Cartels. He follows networks of illegal gun trafficking into American cities and into Mexico and Central America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about illegal gun trafficking within the U.S. and across the border into Mexico and beyond? Do you think changes are needed in U.S. laws or enforcement? We'll talk about that some. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with journalist Johan Grillo about his new book, Blood, Gun, Money, How America Arms Gangs and Cartels. He follows what he and others call the Iron River of illegal gun trafficking into American cities and across the border into Mexico and beyond. You could join in if you have a question at 800-642-1234. Johan, one thing that strikes me in the book is that there's a lot of parallels, as you write about, between the guns that go into, say, Baltimore, where you spent a lot of time, into criminal hands there, and into Mexico and into Central America. Are there policy changes, given how tough it can be to change gun laws, are there policy changes that you think are doable that would actually put a dent into that flow?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we see actually quite low-hanging fruit in this. I mean, one thing we discussed, straw buyers. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's no deterrent, you know, you're not going to get any jail time, you're only going to get probation. And that's why they're paid off for very little money to go and buy guns for cartels, for gangs, often only pay things like $50 for a handgun, $100 for a rifle, and these kind of sums. So simply giving, enforcing that with the law, you can legally give people jail time, could really be a game changer on this. And when you saw circumstances like the Columbine massacre, when there was some illegal gun buying involved there, and there was jail sentences handed out there because there was families and they wanted accountability, we often don't see that, I think, for when these large amount of murders, including of children and stray bullets in the inner cities of the United States and in Mexico. Another thing is the universal background checks. I mean, I've looked at gun trafficking to Mexico, and there's one particular trafficker I interviewed in the prison in Ciudad Juarez, and he had a method of going to gun shows and buying large amounts of AR-15s with no paperwork at all. And driving them back to Mexico. And I saw this in a gun show in Dallas as well, people doing this, offering brand new AR-15s with no paperwork, and saw cases that the ATF had a record where they saw people doing this. Now, it is abusing the law. Supposedly, if you're only a collector selling with no paperwork, you shouldn't be selling new weapons. But people are doing this. So you have this, you know, idea of universal background checks, supported in one survey by 89% of Americans, 81% of conservatives. And that's on the table now, and that could happen. And these could have a big impact on this situation.
Let's bring on a caller now. Jim is with us in Aaron. Jim, hi.
Hi there. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I would like to know how your guest feels about the border walls between Mexico and the U.S. Do they slow traffic? Do they stop traffic? Are they a good idea? I'm just really interested in his point of view.
Jim, thanks for the call. We often think about walls preventing people from moving south to north. Is that something that could help the flow of guns from north to south, Johan?
I don't think it has an impact on the flow of guns from north to south, because most are just driving through what they call the ports of entry, the regular roads. Now, one of the reasons is you have a very high amount of traffic going over the border. So you have hundreds of thousands of vehicles going over, and very few are actually searched. If you drive in a car into Mexico, you might be surprised how easy it is. Now, it also, the walls don't really stop the large volumes of drugs and the high-value drugs going to the United States, meaning heroin, cocaine, crystal meth, and fentanyl. The reason being is most of those drugs also are going through these regular ports of entry, as they're called, hidden in cars, in what they call trap cars with secret compartments. People don't really want to risk going over the, walking over the desert or floating over the river with large amounts of heroin, which is worth a lot of money. So they take it in these cars. And the reality is that in a city like Nuevo Laredo, where you have about 15,000 trucks crossing every day, only very few are searched. So the border wall's main impact is hitting some of the undocumented migrants going over, but also it doesn't really stop. It kind of changes the routes. One of the biggest corridors now for undocumented migrants, which the cartels are also involved now, they control basically undocumented migrants and they'll charge them money. One of the biggest routes is going over the Rio Grande estuary, where it's impossible to build a wall there. And another is a lot of them going in tunnels or finding places in the desert, in the mountains, where the wall does not go through. So it doesn't really have a major impact. It has a kind of more of a psychological impact, perhaps, and stops some of the easier routes of walking into the United States.
Jim, thanks for that call. And that reminds me, Yon, you connect the dots here. We know that a lot, we've got a lot of people showing up at the southern border coming from the few countries to the south of Mexico. And they're being driven out by gangs, armed with, in many cases, the guns you're talking about. Can you connect the dots for us?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you look at the largest number of migrants or refugees, or it's a mix of things really arriving at the southern border, is from Honduras, which I look into closely. I've been covering Honduras for many years, and you've seen a real meltdown of that country, particularly with gang violence. And some of the people I talked to on that trail, I mean, one woman who would be injured by a stray bullet and she was being physically carried by her husband and a friend along the road. Another guy had been shot in both legs, who was a builder and had gone to work on a building site, a construction site in a rival gang neighborhood. So again, what you see is this kind of weird hybrid of crime and war in these countries, fueled or at least the gangs, the cartels are using the guns they're acquiring from the United States, and it's creating very unstable situations. Now, there's a central paradox here, I think, in this story, and that is the United States, whereas it has a lot of guns, it still does have quite strong institutions and despite a lot of criticism, strong policing in the United States against certain organized crime, whereas in Latin America, institutions are much weaker and crime really overwhelms the institutions on this side of the border.
In just our last couple of minutes, Yon, I want to talk about tracking crime guns, something that might surprise a lot of people. When a police department or when a Mexican law enforcement agency calls the ATF, they can't search a database to look up guns. What do they have to do in just our last minute and a half?
Yeah. So I went to the National Trace Center in West Virginia. It's surprising you see these mountains of papers when you go in, which are old records from gun shops. It's illegal to have a digital database of firearms. A lot of cops don't know that. So what they have to do is they have to call up the gun manufacturer and then ask them which wholesaler they sold to, follow the chain. The average time, and this is if you find literally a smoking gun at a crime scene and you call up for a trace, the average time is 11 days, which is quite a lot in a murder investigation. So another one of the many interesting things I discovered looking into the world of firearms and crime guns and firearms trafficking.
Just a half minute or so left. Yon, do you see an appetite to tackle the problem of the illegal flow of illegal firearms?
I see a big window of opportunity now. This issue, you know, is coming up now. There is some discussion about changing this from all kinds of angles. So that's on the positive side. On the negative side, I think politics is quite broken. People are very polarized. And I think this issue, the best way is to kind of find common ground. I don't think about taking away people's Second Amendment rights. It's about having law enforcement and stopping the firearms going to the violent criminals who are causing so much death. And I think most people can agree that's a good thing to do. You have to try and stop these guns going to reduce the bloodshed, which causes so many problems in so many places.
Yon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, all. Great to be here.
That's Yon Grillo, a journalist. We've been talking about his latest book. It's called Blood, Gun, Money, How America Arms Gangs and Cartels. weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, take a tour of classical music and get some great recommendations for your own listening. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll learn more about the tax policy changes President Biden wants in order to help pay for his infrastructure plan. That's part of our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.